Ever since the events of the Capitol riot began to unfold on January 6th, we've been hearing a lot of very hyperbolic terms being used. These include words like coup and insurrection and treason. And it seems the impression we're supposed to get is that some sort of very serious and threatening event occurred at the Capitol on January 6th, something that threatened apparently to unravel the entire regime and would be a threat to all Americans. And so the question now we're left with is, with this attempted revolution of sorts in place, what is now the counter-revolution that must be adopted by the regime in order to ensure that this sort of thing never happens again? And that's what we'll be discussing this time on Radio Rothbard. I'm Ryan McMakin, a senior editor at the Mises Institute, and with me is Tho Bishop, an associate editor. And Tho, I think when we met about this last time and talked about it, we were really only guessing about what the response might be, but it's pretty clear now that the goal is to play this up as much as possible. I've heard comparisons between this and 9/11, between this and Pearl Harbor even, and the word coup was thrown around for quite some time, this idea that there was really an organized attempt to somehow take over the regime. But for most people familiar with coups, if you're honest about it, there's really not much connection there. If this really was an attempted coup, it was one of the most poorly organized, most unlikely to succeed coups imaginable. And let's just compare it to some other coups, right? As I noted in an article for Mises.org, coups generally are carried out by the elites. There's a military detachment of some sort that's involved, trained officers, trained personnel. Of course, if we compare it to, say, the 1973 coup in Chile, where there's jets strafing the presidential palace, if you go there to this day, you can see bullet holes in the surrounding buildings from military-grade weapons and so on. And clearly nothing like that happened at all. But it's clear the rhetoric is that this is something that requires maybe even a military-style response. Certainly a invigorated FBI and whatever is necessary to clamp down on these people who are just outrageously out of hand is what we're being told. And all this, of course, comes after a whole summer of riots that occurred in a variety of other cities. But now things are serious because the Capitol has been threatened. So a lot of the comparisons have been totally outrageous. And Tho, what are some of the most notable reactions you've seen?
The fact that the 9/11 comparison is not hyperbole at all. I mean, you have people that genuinely are trying to portray this as something along those scale, and it's absurd. I think that people that were there in the Capitol, I mean, these are people that are largely very privileged and sheltered lives. I think that the fear is genuine for a lot of these people that were put in offices and things like that. If you were in that situation, I'm sure it would have been very terrifying. I've always thought it was very interesting that Washington never really was the focal point of terrorist sort of behavior that we've seen the last 20 years, given the military action abroad, given the consequences of blowback. And here, this is the first time where the way of life in D.C. really was shaken. And I think that it's had a profound emotional scarring for a lot of these longstanding Washington officials, many of which never really had that much in common with your average Republican voters in the first place. And I think that when you hear these media reports about, Republicans that won't necessarily speak out against it because of, in favor of impeachment or things like that, because they're genuinely afraid of their people back home. I think this really is something that is interesting. It's not something to be dismissive, while at the same time, it doesn't make what happened, all of the exaggeration any more, accurate. I mean, or mock, deserving of mockery from us abroad. But I think that the scarring and the long-term consequences on American politics is going to be something interesting to watch going forward. And you see it really playing out right now. There were several, freshman congressmen who ran explicitly as Trump supporters who have now done 100%, 180 turn against them. People like Nancy Mace from South Carolina, the guy from Michigan who replaced Justin Amash which is interesting because the only reason like that guy had the opportunity there, I mean, Amash's seat became open because Amash voting for impeachment against Trump in the first place. You know, these are people that are, you know, it's not your traditional establishment Republican that's been trying to wait out, you know, the McConnell types. You know, these are new Republicans who I think really were concerned about what happened. And again, I think this reflects the most interesting narrative that we're going to see in American politics for the next 2 to maybe 4 years is what happens to the Republican Party, and this dynamic between the Trump loyalists and, you know, again, I don't even want to necessarily just call it the old guard, but the people that are so desperate to move away from Trump, because, you know, as we talked about last week with political party systems and things like that, I mean, the importance of institutions, the Republican Party is an institution. Who wins that internal battle can dramatically shape that the window of allowable opinion going forward in mainstream American politics. And so I think that the emotional impact on a lot of these people is very real, even though, you know, these people have had a far less sympathy for, you know, the real consequences of all the policies. It couldn't have happened, you know, being scared couldn't have happened to a better group of people. I mean, the consequences of you know, perhaps some of the freshmen have less blood on their hands than others, but I don't feel bad for these people. But at the same time, I recognize that the scarring there is going to have consequences, I think, going forward in ways that are worth watching.
Well, one of the great ironies of our time is that the powerless are held up as grave threats to the social order, whereas the very powerful are often portrayed as martyrs and victims. And so we're now supposed to believe that members of Congress who sit near the peak of power, perhaps not at it, but near it, and certainly have way more power than the average American, are somehow victims of circumstance and are horribly oppressed. Even though they sit near the top of the most well-funded, most powerful government in the history of the world. And this seems like an odd way of portraying things. These are, after all, most of them, not the freshmen perhaps, but people who have approved many, many orders to bomb weddings in Southwest Asia and to starve out children through alliances with Saudi Arabia and such. In the Middle East. And so the notion that some working class mechanic who wanders around in the Capitol is the biggest threat to order in America, while these poor oppressed members of Congress have to go hide and have suffered a grave injustice because of it, seems like a rather topsy-turvy way of looking at things. But what do you think, though? Is it really just a fear-induced response? Because it doesn't seem, like in the case of Mace, that coming out with a full-throated opposition to this sort of thing would be very good for re-election.
That's one of the things I think is very interesting here, is that, you know, you've seen this consolidation of, you know, the especially the freshman congressmen that are you know, out there on Twitter, you know, being as Trumpy as ever, you know, they're now being treated even worse than they were before. And the interesting thing is that, like, if you want, like, let's presume that your interest is in trying to tamper down the anger that manifested itself at this event. You know, if your interest is political stability at the federal level, which, let's be honest, is not my top priority, but for those that's what they want, you know, they want to try to get to something resembling normality. The best thing to do that would be to have these people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, who represents a slice of that Trump electorate, a large slice of that Trump electorate, far better than your average Republican does, and you know, having them go on, you know, being on the House floor, being seen as a representative of their interests, even though she's in no significant position of power to actually act on anything. If you simply want to try to, if you recognize that, you know, this anger is real and you want to try to release it, then you should be, you know, not necessarily, you know, celebrating people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, but you should want people like that in government to make people feel like they're being listened to. Of course, what we have right now is that the arrogance of Washington, the disconnect. I mean, this was always a group of people that were particularly culturally isolated from the rest of America. Now they get to feel themselves as victims. You know, now they get to see them as survivors, right? And it's going to only further alienate the halls of power to the people. And again, in Washington politics, I think it's a little bit different on the left because D.C. is already far more left of center than even most cities, right? I mean, like, it's the Democratic, your average Democratic congressman perhaps is far more center than a lot of the activist base, but at least D.C. itself as a city is far more left than that. Republicans, it's very, very different in that regard. And again, I think that, so that guy, that dynamic on the right is going to be very interesting, I think, going forward.
In looking at how this thing looks like it's going to unfold, it seems that they're just following a playbook that has become quite familiar, right? This goes back to the very early days of the United States. So we can look back on Shays' Rebellion, right? This was a case where you had some farmers, they took up arms against their creditors. They had fought in the war. They were now being harassed by those to whom they owed some money. And they didn't want to do it. They didn't want to give up their farms. So there was a small-scale rebellion. This was easily put down by the Massachusetts militia, but that wasn't enough for the very wealthy, powerful people of the United States, people like George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, Madison, and so on. They basically panicked, and they thought, there's too much freedom in this country. We've got to stop. The big buzzword at the time was licentiousness. There's too much licentiousness going on. We got to do something about it because these countries that have democratic elections and so on, they just end up using their freedom to destroy themselves. And so you ended up with this much more powerful central government than you had under the older constitution. And this enabled, of course, over the next 200 years for the state to gain massive amounts of power and to really silence a lot of these minority groups that had done much better under the old constitution. Unfortunately, a lot of these Trump supporters themselves have somewhat been conned by that whole thing. They continue to read things like the Federalist Papers and think these are all just statements of fact and not politically motivated documents that Alexander Hamilton just wanted what was best for the country. He didn't have any controversial views. He was a founding father. We have to believe what he says, of course. What he was doing when he was writing the Federalist Papers was to do exactly what the Democrats are going to try and do now, which is push a much more powerful government because he has identified some enemy group within the U.S. population that he wants to get rid of and to clamp down on. And so this is an example of what not to do in the case of Shays' Rebellion. But there have been other deadlier cases, of course. Same thing happened with the Oklahoma City bombing. We were led to believe that there were militias hiding everywhere that were going to be bombing major urban centers and trying to take over the country. That, of course, proved to not be true at all. And after 9/11, then, the same thing happened. We need a lot more government power, but most of it's going to be exercised against Americans. We now need more spy powers. We need all sorts of new anti-terrorist powers. And this occurred in 1996 with the Anti-Terrorist Act of that year. And then, of course, the Patriot Act after 9/11. So this is something very common, and we apparently haven't seen the end of it.
I'm by no means a fan of his. But Ben Shapiro actually touches on this in Politico this morning. Talked about how a lot of Republicans, you know, didn't want to jump on the impeached Trump train because, you know, even though conservatives have missed the ball for decades, you know, the entire conservative movement has been defined by failure and impotency and the inability of recognizing where the true levers of power really are. The last 4 years have I think red-pilled enough of them to recognize that, again, when you have Ben Shapiro saying, like, the reason why you don't have more Republicans joining attempts to impeach Donald Trump is because they recognize that the left is not going to stop with Trump and go after, and they're going to lump every single conservative the same way as they do the people at the Capitol. That is what I think makes it so different, because it's, you know, I think the difficulty of trying to, you know, it's easy when you're able to take a group, you know, like what happened at Ruby Ridge and cast them as the fringe and have, you know, you have a coordinated nonstop media campaign against all the levers of information. that follows the script and portrays them as what they are, and it allows for the number of people that relate to them. You had to be very, I think there's going to be a lot more that resonate with the concerns of the overreach of the state in reaction to this than there have been in the past. And that's again, where I think that again, the arrogance of those in power, I think that the deep state is as evil as it's ever been. I just think there's a lot more mediocre people in it, and their inability to appreciate the fact that so much of the power they've had in the past has been dependent upon, the ability to manufacture consent along a large national scale. That has, I think, been fatally wounded. And you see it, I think, now that we have more and more polling coming out, not that you want to take polling as 100% accurate, but one of the consistent things is that, the Republican, mainstream Republican view on Trump after Capitol Hill, it is a majority position that Joe Biden should not be inaugurated at all on January 20th by Republican voters. There's so many more average, normal Americans. I mean, probably the majority of several states that believe in these views that they're going to try to criminalize. That, I think, makes this power dynamic very a lot different than some of these past episodes. And that's going to create a dynamic where, again, especially if you start getting, if you have, let's say, the state of Mississippi or Alabama, which is so red, and you probably do have a majority of people in some of these states that do not believe Joe Biden's illegitimate. If you combine that with a governor that is bold enough to lean into that, you could really start to have a dynamic that creates some interesting things.
I think another thing that sets this event apart is that it's easy to be sympathetic with some of the people involved in this case, where obviously that was not the case with 9/11 or Oklahoma City. Because when you look around and you see some of the people involved, they seem to really have no idea what they're doing. They're wandering around the Capitol like tourists. They're waving flags. They're taking pictures with statues and so on. Now, some people involved clearly appear to have bigger plans. Maybe they were planning to kidnap some people or force some sort of action by the Congress or so on. That's all still unclear, but it seems like it's a possibility. And some of the people didn't seem to understand any of that might have been going on. And nevertheless, these people now have the FBI coming to their homes and they're facing federal charges. And they're really likely to experience the full brunt of the federal legal system, which is not something you want to deal with. It's tilted much more in favor of prosecutors than is the state and local system. And so it seems that it's a very different situation in that sense. And so what is your impression? I mean, what was going through the minds of a lot of these people who are involved with this?
Well, I think there's kind of two camps here. One was the people that just got caught up in the moment and, particularly get in. I mean, for a lot of these people, they didn't break in, by smashing in windows to get in. I mean, there is video of the Capitol Police kind of let them come in. And again, being able to protest and occupy a government building to show your dissatisfaction with behavior, this was normalized behavior. Not that, this is not, unprecedented. Again, this happened with Brett Kavanaugh things at the Senate building, right? Other side of the, right next door to the Capitol. I mean, this is nothing unusual. But I do think that there was another hardcore relevant aspect to this of people that, there's, one of the cultural zeitgeist social media things out there has been, the QAnon stuff and these other sort of things where basically the belief was that, for all of the show going on in the news and that at the core of the government, there was military actors and other powerful people, that have been planning for years to take down corrupt, satanic, Democratic politicians. And that, all of this was leading to the point where, the plan was going to be revealed and people were going to, and action was going to taken. And that, if it was taken as a faith, right? that if they go there and they stand their ground, then, you know, all the traitors are going to be taken care of. Corruption is going to be washed out of Washington, D.C. Trump's going to, you know, be vindicated. They gave, you know, Joe Biden, you know, secret information, and it's now in Chinese hands. And so, like, it's now, you know, clear as day. You know, we have double agents in the government, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so you had all of these narratives that were being shared in social media that I think gave people the belief that, hey, look, if we do our part and we take the People's Building, then we will be followed up with reinforcements by the, you know, our aspect of the deep state, right? And we're going to win this battle. And that's, you know, that's the real tragedy in this. I think people that had, you know, intentions that, you know, these are people that were genuinely thinking that they were saving their country, that they were on the right, on the side of God, that got caught up in, you know, these conspiracy theories, you know, these narratives that were, I don't know if, you know, the original origin, but I think it encouraged these people to act in ways that they might not have otherwise. And now they have to pay the consequences for it. And that's something I think is really, really sad. But it also goes to the fact that, again, there's a lot of conservatives that still want to believe that the government's on their side, right? They still want to believe that, okay, well, if they elect the right person, then we're going to save Washington. And you know, we're going to bring America back to the 1950s. And you know, we're going to live in one great patriotic country. And that's obviously not going to happen. You know, Washington, D.C. is full of evil, horrible people. There's nobody in there that wants to save you. There's not these institutions within the federal government that are trying to make America great again. You know, there's some political leaders that might. There's Democratic actors that might be voted in, but the true power doesn't lie in them. You know, even the President of the United States had his orders, you know, undermined and subverted by bureaucrats. And so hopefully, if there's any big lesson that the American right learns, is that, you know, there is no salvation to be found in D.C. There is no cabal that's going to bring us back on and you know, right all of our wrongs. I mean, it's going to come up to, you know, people outside of D.C. acting. But I think that really was one of the main motivations that kind of helped lead this to the point where it got.
Yes, I agree. I think this may have been a case of many people horribly misreading the situation, of believing all that rhetoric about 4D chess, how Trump was one step ahead of everything. And so even if they knew, they probably shouldn't have been walking around the Capitol taking pictures and so on. They were probably going to be fine, right? Because the president was going to step in. He had some trick up his sleeve and he was going to take care of them and he had everything under control. And of course, in reality, they were just making themselves sitting ducks for federal prosecutors. And it's going to be a big problem for a lot of them. And it's a valuable lesson in terms of understanding the limits of presidential power. Yes, Trump was the president, but that doesn't mean much when the whole bureaucracy is aligned against you, when the FBI and the Pentagon are actively conspiring against you to disregard your orders, to investigate you, to spy on you, to create documents that make you look bad. And all these things are going on, and a president who's dealing with that is not especially powerful. Indeed, Trump may very well be the weakest president since the 19th century. And I think if people understood that a little bit better and why that is, they wouldn't have assumed that Trump had some special trick that he was going to pull out and make everybody's dreams come true. And so, as you say, that's a real bad way of thinking. And trust me, Washington, D.C. is probably not going to do anything to rescue you, to fix your life, to make everything okay. It doesn't matter really who you elect. Because if you elect anyone that's really against the regime, like, say, Ron Paul, the regime is going to act accordingly and work to sabotage that president in every way they can. So we'll have to wrap up there for this episode of Radio Rothbart. Thank you, Tho, for joining me yet again. And we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, have a wonderful week.